It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, creative writing. What do you find in a writer's workspace? A laptop? Pencils? Dictionary? Well, you know what else? Demons. Anxiety. Depression. And for some of the greatest writers, alcohol.
People like Hemingway, for example, like to start drinking as a way of changing the channel, as a way of letting off the pressure of the day, of that sort of incredibly focused work that he was doing.
The link between alcohol, addiction, and creativity in this hour. And how do you overcome a writer's block or vanquish an inner critic? Channel the trickster.
One of the things that trickster is very good at is nudging you from a backsided direction and knocking you into a different path that is more fruitful.
Jumpstarting the imagination today. Beginning with a Russian-American trickster of a writer, Gary Steingart. He's famous for his wickedly sardonic novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, Absurdistan, Super Sad True Love Story. Steingart has had the kind of literary success a lot of writers would kill for. Even his book trailers go viral, which could have something to do with the fact that James Franco stars in them. So it doesn't seem quite fair that he's titled his new memoir Little Failure.
Little Failure was a cute nickname that my mom had for me when I was growing up. When I graduated from Oberlin College in Ohio, they expected me, after $100,000 in tuition, to become a lawyer or something like that. And I came out to them and said, look, I want to be a writer. And one day my mother was visiting my 100-square-foot apartment on the Lower East Side, which back then Manhattan wasn't fully gentrified completely. And I was living in this tiny place with sloping floors and a water bug so big he looked like he could have been my roommate. And she looked around and said, my God, you're such a failure-chka, which is in the diminutive word of failure, the English word failure, but chka makes it little. So that was my moniker, and it kind of stuck, you know.
Well, the chka makes it sound little and sort of sweet. I mean, does that make it sort of affectionate?
Yeah, she was affectionately saying that I was a little failure.
So this seems kind of characteristic of your family, the barbed joke, the hostility disguised as affection, or vice versa.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. Do you think it's a Russian thing or a family tradition or both?
Well, it could be a Russian thing, although since the book came out, I've been touring a lot, and people from all kinds of different ethnicities have been coming up and saying, yeah, I'm getting that too. That kind of barbed humor, and also the constant put-downs. And the constant put-downs are supposed to make sure that the child, even if the child is, let's say, 37 years old, still goes on to medical school or dental school or law school and fulfills the parents' ambitions, because the parents had to give up everything to come to this country. And so the child feels it upon themselves to continue that tradition. One reader in New York came up to have her book signed, and she said, can you sign it to, quote, a little failure's failed paralegal? And I almost cried. I thought, you poor woman, you're not a failure. You can do whatever you want.
Well, so it sounds like you grew up in a family in which there was almost always a subtext or a double meaning.
Yes, and that is great for a writer. The jokes they tell, the satire they use, the stuff that you mentioned, you know, is hostility masquerading as affection or affection masquerading as hostility. All that kind of stuff is wonderful for a writer. I encourage all writers to be called little failure by their parents, all budding writers, because it really focuses your mind on language and the way language is used. And even if it's not used in a way that soothes you, it will be material at some point.
Mm. Now, well, that was why I asked, because I think that although that sounds like a damaging, somewhat, environment, it probably was really great training for a writer. So how do you think that shaped your particular voice and your interests as a writer?
Well, before my memoir, the three books I've written have been satires. And I think that growing up with parents from the Soviet Union, growing up partly in the Soviet Union, telling Brezhnev jokes, you know, was just how people bonded, making fun of the government, making fun of the ridiculous system. So I think I always grew up with a very kind of jaundiced eye, just looking at things very skeptically. That's not a great way to be as a person, but it's a great way to be as a writer. Most writers I know are probably not going to win Happiest Woman or Happiest Man of the Year awards. They just aren't that happy. And especially the funny writers, I notice. The funnier you are, the more I think there's a tragic undercurrent.
Now, why do you think that is?
Because I think humor is one of the highest forms of tragedy there is. People talk about the serious novel in these sort of hallowed tones and how important it is. But I think a lot of the humorous stuff, books by writers like Sam Lipsyte and even writers like Mordecai Richler in Canada, who's no longer with us, these are some of the most funny and tragic books I know, because humor doesn't work unless you're making fun of something that keeps paper cutting you throughout your life, something that keeps hurting and hurting you. And that's why parents and relationships and the political system are such delicious targets.
The really depressing thing, which is both depressing, painful, and funny, the way you tell it, is there was this comment your father made to you, it sounded like not that long ago, when he said, I think by then you were a successful writer, and he said something like, yeah, well, a friend of mine told me nobody will ever remember your books.
No, the actual quote was, I read on the Russian internet that soon you and your novels will be forgotten, which I loved so much that I remember taking out my phone and just typing it down. It just sounded so awesome and so almost Old Testament. Soon you and your novel will be forgotten.
And there's so much verity that I read on the Russian internet.
I read on the Russian internet. So some Masha from Minsk said, you know, whatever. It never really ends. You can be a big success, but if Misha for Moorman says you're a schmuck, then you're a schmuck.
I thought I heard overtones of kind of Soviet hatred of the capitalist pig Americans in there, too. You know, so the Russian internet says, soon, you capitalist writer, your works will be forgotten.
One of the headlines, not the headlines, but one of the reviews of one of my books in Russian was, Balding Traitor Betrays Motherland. So there's a fine tradition of that. But I remember watching a documentary where Woody Allen goes back to his parents and his mother, and they say, well, how do you feel about all your son's successes? And the mother said, I still think he should have been a pharmacist.
You know? Right.
So it never ends.
Yeah. So I want to go back to your very beginnings as a writer. You have a wonderful memory of writing your first, admittedly very short, novel at the tender age of 5, I think. Yeah. What was it?
Yeah, Lenin and His Magical Goose. My grandmother was a journalist for Evening Leningrad, a newspaper in Leningrad, and she said, can you write a small novel for me, and I'll pay you a slice of cheese for each page you write. And I loved this Soviet cheese. I was very excited. So I wrote 100 pages for 100 slices of cheese, and it was called Lenin and His Magical Goose, and I loved Lenin. There was a huge statue. The biggest statue of Lenin in all of Leningrad was right outside of our building. And so I wrote a novel in which Lenin meets a magical goose from a southern clime, Armenia or Georgia, let's say, and they invade Finland and they create a socialist revolution in Finland. They make Finland safe for socialism, but then a fight breaks out between Lenin and the goose, and Lenin eats the goose because the goose is Menshevik and Lenin is Bolshevik. So, so a 5-year-old kid, but, you know, in Russia, a 5-year-old could be a pretty well-educated kid.
Yeah, but that's such a dark and depressing story. I mean, already with the betrayal.
Already with the betrayal, already political arguments are breaking out, geese are being eaten. But it's tragicomic when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, so then there's another kind of key moment in your development as a writer. It's some years later, you've emigrated to the U.S. where you are, of course, one of those deeply unpopular, picked-on kids at school. What didn't they like about you?
You got to remember, this is 1980, and it's the evil empire era, Reagan's evil empire speech, and the movies are out there, the Red Dawn, Red Hamster, whatever, you know, it's just, it never ends. So the kids are pushing me into the wall and screaming Rusky and Commie and all that. I'm pretending I was born in East Berlin instead of being born in Leningrad. I'm in a Hebrew school. I'm trying to get Jewish kids to think I'm a German, because that's better than being a Russian, you know. And at the same time, I start writing these little science fiction books because I love science fiction. And there's a very nice teacher who lets me read them at the end of each English period. And then I write the Genora, which is a satire in the Torah, you know, where Exodus becomes Sexodus and all this kind of stuff. And so the point is that I make my first friends. Through writing, I make my first friends. Earlier, because of my writing, my grandmother gave me cheese and loved me. And Random House still pays me in cheese. The tradition continues, you know. And now these kids like me because I write. So somewhere inside my psyche is the idea is born that the only way I can get people to really like me is by constantly writing. Or if I stop writing, I'm the red hamster again. You know?
There's a really funny passage that I wondered if you would read for us.
Okay.
It's the passage about your family receiving a letter from the publisher's clearinghouse.
Okay.
Maybe you could just set it up for us.
This is about 2 years after we leave Russia, and we are not wealthy. In 1981, an official letter arrives in our mailbox. Mr. S. Weingart, you have already won $10 million. Sure, our last name is misspelled rather cruelly, but cardstock this thick does not lie. And the letter is from a major American publisher, to wit, the Publisher's Clearing House. I open the letter with shaking hands, and a check falls out. Pay to the order of S. Weingart, $10 million and 00/$100. Our lives are about to change. I run down the stairs into the courtyard of our apartment complex. Mama, Papa, we won, we won. We are millionaires. Calm down, my father says. Do you want an asthma attack? But he's nervous and excited himself. Around the glowing surface of the orange dining table imported from Romania, we spread around the contents of the voluminous packet. For 2 years, we have been good news citizens, while accidentally watching X-rated movies on Main Street, getting jobs as engineers and clerk typists, learning to pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and for the something for which that it stands, unavoidable with money for all. Bonjour, moi, my mother says. My God, as we look at the pictures on the envelope of a Mercedes flying off the deck of our yacht toward our new mansion with its Olympic-sized swimming pool. Oi, does it have to be a Mercedes? Poo, they're Nazis. Don't worry, we can trade it for a Cadillac. Bonjour, moi, how many bedrooms does this house have? 7, 8, 9. You can forget about the yacht, Gary, it's dangerous. But I know how to swim, Mama. How do you keep the pool open in the winter? Snow will get in. Look, there's palm trees. Maybe it's in Florida. Florida won't be good for your asthma with all that humidity. I want to live in Miami. Maybe there aren't Hebrew schools in Miami. Everywhere in America, there are Hebrew schools. That night in my dreams, I walk into the Solomon Schechter School of Queens, a multimillionaire. And the pretty girl with the big teeth, who's always tanned from her Florida vacation, kisses me with those big teeth. I haven't gotten the mechanics of kissing down yet. The kids make fun of Jonah Himmelstein, the school's biggest loser, but I say, hey, he's my friend now. Here is $2. Buy us both the Carvel Flying Saucer cookie ice cream and keep the change, you gurnished, you nothing.
Oh, it's hilarious and it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah.
Or I don't know, is that a good memory?
Yeah, that's one of the better ones.
You write a lot about the past, and the past, and your family's past in the Soviet Union overshadows everything. You wound up going back with your parents to the Soviet Union in 2011. Was that a pivotal trip? Did it put anything to rest?
It did. It did. You know, you grow up with tough immigrant parents, and in your 20s, earlier than that, maybe even a little bit later than that, they want you so much to be who they want you to be, you develop a huge sense of anger toward them, rage sometimes. And I think going back with them and seeing the difficulties of how they grew up, of how much apart Stalin and Hitler were of their earliest years. They were born to a bombed out country. My father's first memory is diving under a train as the Germans strafed the train and they were being evacuated from Leningrad. After a while, you hear these stories and you see them walk through the places where all these things happened. And the feelings of rage become feelings of sorrow and sadness and a kind of sorrow that they didn't grow up in a better country under better circumstances, that they didn't have a chance to pursue the dreams that they wanted to pursue. My father wanted very much to be an opera singer. And I think in a normal country, his beautiful voice maybe would have had a chance, but certainly not there.
Gary Steingart's new memoir is called Little Failure. And if you haven't seen it yet, don't miss the book trailer, which features James Franco as Gary's pink bathrobe-wearing husband and Jonathan Franzen as his hostile therapist. We'll post it on our website, ttbook.org. Like all of us, writers battle demons, complicated family relationships, depression, anxiety, and no one understands self-medication better than a writer. Olivia Lang grew up in an alcoholic family. When she was 17, she read Tennessee Williams' play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof about a dysfunctional, alcohol-ravaged marriage. Williams was an alcoholic himself, and wanting to know more, Lang traveled across America to investigate the lives of six great alcoholic writers. Producer Doug Gordon talked with her about her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking.
You focus on six American writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Tennessee Williams, John Berryman, John Cheever, and Raymond Carver. Why did you choose these particular six writers?
I knew from the beginning that Tennessee Williams had to be there, that my connection to him and his work was very important. And then I wanted people who had a kind of commonality. I wanted this book to have a coherence and not just be a sort of series of separate portraits. So I needed people who either knew each other, like Hemingway and Fitzgerald knew each other, or people who were interested in each other, like John Berryman was very interested in Ernest Hemingway. He felt that they had things in common and he was fascinated by him. The other thing that's important to say is that I wanted people whose work I genuinely thought was marvellous, because I was going to be drawing out all of these difficult elements of their lives, because I was going to be handling stuff that was so unpleasant, these scenes of real kind of wreckage. I didn't just want to write a hatchet job. I didn't want to write this sort of cruel, exposing book. And I wanted to have that as the kind of antidote. I wanted to be able to present them at their best as well as at their absolute worst.
Mm. Is it possible to say that the six writers you profiled, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Williams, Berryman, Cheever, and Carver, used alcohol for similar reasons? Or were there any common denominators in the reasons that they drank?
I think there are common denominators, absolutely. The interesting thing, and one of the sort of first myths that I realised wasn't quite true, is that people tend to write drunk. And actually, that happened very rarely. Fitzgerald did it sometimes and often regretted having to do it. But mostly they were using drink for other reasons. And I think I can probably summarise those. Partly it was to do with, at the end of a working day, people like Hemingway, for example, like to start drinking as a way of changing the channel, as a way of letting off the pressure of the day, of that sort of incredibly focused work that he was doing, which is something that I'm sure worked very well at the beginning of his life and later on had far bleaker consequences. But then, and much more importantly, I think, there's a way in which drinking was used to self-medication, and you see that with almost all of them. In fact, I think all of them, that they suffered, and often from a very young age, from things like anxiety, social unease, depression. And drinking was, in the beginning, an almost magical key to a more confident, competent, almost weightless self, somebody that wasn't burdened by these feelings that they felt themselves so burdened by. And you see that very clearly with somebody like Tennessee Williams, who used to suffer from really bad panic attacks. He'd often think that he was literally going to go mad from his panic attacks. And of course, his sister did go mad, so it wasn't a sort of a random fear. And once he started drinking, once he got to grips with drinking, he realised that he was this passport out of these terrible feelings that he was experiencing. And the problem with that, of course, is that alcohol is an addictive, poisonous substance. It works very well initially, but because of its effect on the brain adjusts to it. And when you take it away, all of those feelings of anxiety come crowding back, and you need more drink and more drink and more drink to stop it.
Mm-hmm. At one point in The Trip to Echo Spring, you write that by traveling through these various locations in sequence, you thought that it would be possible to build a kind of topographical map of alcoholism. And that's such a beautiful, evocative phrase. What do you mean by that, Olivia?
Well, there'd been other books about alcohol and writers, and they tended to be structured in terms of one portrait after another portrait after another portrait. And I noticed that there was a similar trajectory in all of those, that they'd start sort of the early carefree, light-hearted days of drinking, and then gradually the alcoholism would gather and would start becoming much more addictive, much more dangerous, and then you'd end up with these deaths. And I thought, well, if all of these stories have the same arc, then maybe it's the arc that I want to look at. And that's what I tried to do. And I wanted to plot that out across the country. So in New York, I'm looking at these early days of drinking, these sort of intoxicating days of drinking. And as I travel down through New Orleans to Florida, I'm looking much more about the alcoholism as it starts to hit, and Tennessee Williams' last awful years, and what happened to Hemingway, which we all know is just a complete tragedy. I moved on up to St. Paul, and that's really where the book reaches its sort of nadir, is dealing with the poet John Berryman, who committed suicide there. And then I travel on to Port Angeles to really look at the recovery stories of the people who managed to get sober and who managed to draw back these extraordinary second lives. And that's where I handle the material that's about John Cheever, but particularly Raymond Carver.
Mm-hmm. Of the six writers you feature in the trip to Echo Spring, which writer's story do you think is the most tragic?
Clearly what happened to John Berryman, who ended up killing himself, he committed suicide jumping off a bridge after going through recovery three times and realising he just couldn't find it in himself to get sober. That was a very tragic story. But the one that touched me the most, I think, is Tennessee Williams, who I absolutely adore. And the reason for that is Tennessee, his drinking was in a very bad place, probably by the 60s, maybe even a little earlier. His beloved partner, Frank Merlo, died of cancer. And after that, I mean, they were estranged anyway before. And after that, Tennessee went into what he described as his stoned age. And an inelegant way of putting it is he really lost the plot. And the thing that I find very moving about his life is that he got sober again after that and then carried on drinking again. So he never quite achieved sobriety, but he never stops working. And if you think about Tennessee Williams' life and his body of work, after something like Night of the Iguana, which comes after Cat and Art to Move, Streetcar Named Desire, the sort of the big famous plays, his plays become much more difficult. They're damaged by the alcohol he's been taking. And the critics hate them. The critics absolutely savage him. His plays start failing. Audiences drop off. He really goes through these serial humiliations. And he never stops writing. He gets up every morning, he drinks his black coffee, he sits down at the typewriter and he works. And there's something about that work ethic, there's something about that desire to create, despite how agonizing he's finding the experience of his creation's recognition, that I found really deeply moving.
Mm-hmm. Did you uncover any evidence, Olivia, that as his plays, his later plays, met with the poor reviews, did he drink more heavily?
His drinking, yeah, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And he knew even very early on in his diaries, there's this extraordinary entry where he says, the play I'm working on is being damaged by my drinking. I know it is. I can't stop because my anxiety is so bad that if I stop, I'll go crazy. But I know it's affecting my work. It's affecting structure. It's affecting coherence. All those things did start happening later. But the play he's talking about is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is structurally perfect. So he knew, even at that early stage, that he was really on a very dangerous road. And I think his experience of just being Tennessee Williams, his experience of being Tom Williams, his experience of inhabiting his own body was so difficult for him that you can see where the drinking comes in, but the drinking made it a billion times worse.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'd forgotten that. I was about to ask you what play that was.
I couldn't believe it when I realized.
Yeah, and that's amazing that it was one of his classics, a relatively early play. I'd like to end by having you read a passage from your book. It's about your visit to Raymond Carver's grave. And
yeah,
if you can set it up a bit.
I will do. So at the very end of the book, I travel to Port Angeles. I spend some time there. The last thing I do before I leave is go to Raymond Carver's grave, which is just outside the town of Port Angeles. This is on the Olympic Peninsula, which is a very beautiful, mountainous piece of land on the Juan de Fuca Strait. Under a bench, I found the black metal box I'd heard about. I opened it and pulled out a Ziploc bag. Inside was a spiral-bound notebook. I squatted down on the grass and started reading. The sun was streaming through the trees in dusty shafts, stirrable as honey. It was a visitor's book, each entry written in a different hand. Gallagher used it the most, but there were also many letters from strangers and old friends. Some wanted to say how much Carver's writing meant to them, and others talked about addiction in tones that sounded as if they were speaking to a priest or an AA sponsor. Someone non-judgmental and sympathetic. Spending is an escape, just like alcohol, one read. We are all trying to fill that empty hole. Another. I started drinking. Hard. If I can keep my head above water, hopefully I won't drown. I turned 23 yesterday. Tess had scribbled a reply to that one. Ray would say, have faith. Grasp at straws and go to AA. I was crying by then. Faith. In the end, recovery depends on faith, of one kind or another. Carver once said he didn't believe in God, but I have to believe in miracles and the possibility of resurrection, no question about that. Every day that I wake up, I'm glad to wake up. It's this faith that became explicit in his late stories, Cathedral, Errand, Intimacy, though there are traces of it in things he wrote much earlier too. It struck me then that by driving out to a writer's grave, all these anonymous, suffering strangers were putting their faith in stories, in the capacity of literature to somehow salve a sense of soreness, to make one feel less flinchingly alone. I thought of myself as a child, of how I became a reader because tracts of my life were unendurable. In 1969, 6 years before he got sober, John Cheever was asked by the Paris Review if he felt godlike at the typewriter. Perhaps you could read his answer as a delusion, the word Berryman scratched all through the proofs of his own interview. Perhaps it wasn't, though. Perhaps it could be taken at face value. No, I've never felt godlike. No, the senses of one's total usefulness. We all have a power of control. It's part of our lives. We have it in love, in work that we love doing. It's a sense of ecstasy, as simple as that. The sense is, this is my usefulness and I can do it all the way through. It always leaves you feeling great. In short, you've made sense of your life.
Olivia Lang, reading from her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, on writers and drinking. She spoke with producer Doug Gordon. Lang says John Cheever's 1964 short story, The Swimmer, is one of the finest ever written about an alcoholic's life. Here's Cheever himself reading two excerpts from The Swimmer, along with some commentary from Olivia Lang.
It was one of those midsummer Sundays when everyone sits around saying, "I drank too much last night." You might have heard it whispered by the parishioners leaving church, heard it from the lips of the priest himself, struggling with his cassock in the vestiarium. Heard it from the golf links and the tennis courts. Heard it from the wildlife preserve where the leader of the Audubon group was suffering from a terrible hangover. "I drank too much," said Donald Westerhazy. "We all drank too much," said Lucinda Merrill. "It must have been the wine," said Helen Westerhazy. "I drank too much of that claret."
It's such a wonderful, strange story. It's about a man who decides to swim home from a party by way of his neighbor's swimming pools, which is such a wonderful idea. And it's a single day, but it also isn't. The weather seems to change, the climate seems to change, it seems to become winter. He's at first greeted with great friendliness by his neighbours, and gradually with more and more hostility. There are abandoned houses. Things seem to have gone through some strange change that he doesn't quite understand. And by the end of the story, he finds himself at his own house, but it's empty. Nobody's lived there for a long time. And it's clear from little hints that are dropped throughout the story that he is an alcoholic, that he has gone through the losses that many alcoholics go through, that he's estranged from his children and his wife. And it seems to catch in a very few pages the entirety of that nosedive that alcohol can take somebody through.
He tried the garage doors to see what cars were in, but the doors were locked and rust came off the handles onto his hands. Going towards the house, he saw that the force of the thunderstorm had knocked one of the rain gutters loose. It hung down over the front door like an umbrella rib, but it could be fixed in the morning. The house was locked, and he thought that the stupid cook or the stupid maid must have locked the place up, until he remembered that it had been some time since they had employed a maid or a cook. He shouted, pounded on the door, tried to force it with his shoulder, and then, looking in at the window, saw that the place was empty.
John Cheever, reading the end of his short story, The Swimmer. Coming up, how to clear writer's blocks and demolish inner critics with the help of a mysterious, mischievous figure, the trickster. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In the early 90s, artist and writer Nick Bantock redefined what a book could be with the hugely successful Griffin and Sabine trilogy. The books are mysterious stories told in part through letters and postcards and collages. Bantock also teaches a popular workshop on creativity as mischief-making, and he's just assembled his favorite exercises into a book featuring his trademark collages and an unusual muse. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Now, your book is called The Trickster's Hat, and the trickster is kind of like our tour guide through all of the creative exercises in the book. Who exactly is the trickster?
Well, the trickster appears throughout many cultures and society. He's a mischievous character that is liable to tie your bootlaces together or trip you up or knock your coffee cup off when you're not looking. Anything that he can do to encourage you towards being more self-aware and embracing life with all its potential.
So kind of knocking you out of your routines, I guess.
Definitely. One of the biggest problems of the creative path for people who are professional or semi-professional is that they get stuck in ruts. And one of the things that Trickster is very good at is nudging you from a backsided direction and knocking you into a different path that is more fruitful.
Was there a particular time or a moment when the Trickster became especially important to you personally?
I think he's always been there. I don't think I was conscious of him in that form, but he's such an essential part of our archetypal structure that it's almost as though he's always trying to break through our peripheral vision. But if we're too trapped in some colluded perception of a single reality, we don't allow him in.
So do you consciously try to call up the trickster when you're doing something creative? I mean, do you, I don't know, try to create situations where the trickster appears?
No, the door is permanently open now for me. What I do try and do, though, is to not rely on the notion of the muse. I prefer that Spanish concept of duende, where you make yourself into a culvert through which the fire or energy or enthusiasm or curiosity of creativity can come through. So it's less about ego and far more about developing your craft and then making yourself available to just see what happens. But apart from anything else, it's so much more exciting.
So what's wrong with the muse?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the muse, but if you have to sit around and wait for the muse's whim, which may or may not come or may disappear for 30 years, you're not going to be an ongoingly creative person, but you also won't have the sense that you have choice.
Yeah. Now, you are probably best known for your groundbreaking and best-selling Griffin and Sabine books from the early 1990s. And for those of our listeners who are not familiar with those books, can you tell us a bit about them?
It's a correspondence between two people, one who lives in London, one who lives in the South Seas. Griffin, the guy, lives in London. He's never really sure at first who Sabine is. In fact, the whole premise of the story is, for a long time, we don't actually know if she exists. The physical form of the book is a series of postcards and envelopes where the letters are actually inside the envelope. So as you turn the page, you can get a chance to read somewhere else's mail. It's, you know, highly voyeuristic in that sense. It's very pictorial. It's a romance. It's a metaphysical journey. It's an alchemical tract. But it's mostly an adventure in the love of finding yourself and finding somebody else.
And it strikes me that one of the things that was so original about those books is you kind of pioneered this sense of interactivity before there was anything like, hyperlinks on the computer. You're sort of breaking out of the bounds of what a book was supposed to be.
Yeah, it was in many ways described as a new genre. And you have to remember that it was virtually pre-email. So at that time, the notion of letters and postcards was a definitive means of communication between two people at distance.
Now, in your new book, The Trickster's Hat, you have come up with 49 creative exercises for us. And one of the things that you often recommend in these exercises is the use of collage. Why is collage so fertile for the imagination?
It's fast. It allows people who are in some way scared of the notion of art or frightened that I can't draw or I've never used paint, it allows for a means of working that creates imagery that is both accidental and subconsciously intentional. Collage is available to anybody who finds a bunch of magazines or any paper ephemera and starts ripping them up and sticking them down. Obviously, the more you work, the more it becomes complex. The notion that you put in 10,000 hours at something and you start to get reasonably good at it, that would apply to collage as well. But the real advantage of collage is you're moving forward from the second you start.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also takes away some of that horror of, let's say, if you're a writer, you know, sitting down with a blank page and you've got to sort of start from scratch there. I mean, I guess you have something to work with to begin with.
Yeah, and that leads us into the whole notion of writing and creating art and how they can feed each other. For a long time, people have had a tendency to think that the words come first and then the images follow as illustrations. But in fact, if you think of our nighttime activities in dreaming, it's a series of intuitive images that we're responding to. So if you can make the left side and the right side of your brain meet in some kind of marriage or harmony, then both sides, the imagery and the text, can feed each other. And that's what a lot of these exercises are designed to do, is to help people become more balanced in their creative process, but also very, very much to take away the notion of block. Because if you're working from one side and you don't know what comes next, you just quickly flip to the other, take a risk, and then just go from there. In other words, it's all about trusting the process.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about a few of your specific exercises. Exercise number 4, pictorial autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in this?
The idea is that we all need to tell our own life story. To sit down and write a long novel or autobiography defining our existence usually ends up in a series of self-justifications. We're inevitably going to do that. So if you can get over that in about 20 minutes or half an hour, it actually is then going to release you to start doing something that is less self-conscious and less self-justifying. So this little autobiographic exercise is a matter of telling your complete life story in a series of little images, but constructed in a very, very short period of time and from found material, not from the pictures of you as a little kid. But if you have to build your life story out of pages torn from a magazine or a newspaper or bits of old money or whatever it is you're using, it forces you to see your life in a different way.
Mick Bantock is the author of The Trickster's Hat, A Mischievous Apprenticeship in Creativity. He talked with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about this hour or any other, you can get in touch with us through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, jazz legend Charlie Parker is on our minds this week, plus a dangerous idea. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension and
ideas, the intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
My name is Steven Pinker. I am a professor of psychology at Harvard University and the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And my dangerous idea is that we may be living in the most peaceable time in our species' existence. Despite everything you read in the newspapers about shooting sprees and terrorist attacks and civil wars, as a proportion of the world's population, more and more of us are living free of violence and dying of natural causes. You can see this in data on rates of death in tribal warfare, which are far higher than those of modern societies, even in the midst of wars. You see this in calculations of rates of homicide over history. A contemporary European has about 1/50th the chance of being murdered as his medieval ancestor. You see this in the abolition of barbaric practices that were ubiquitous through human history and then were abolished. Human sacrifice, throwing virgins into volcanoes to placate an angry god, burning heretics at the stake, breaking people at the wheel, executing people for shoplifting or counterfeiting, legalized slavery. Less obviously, you see it in rates of death in warfare. War has not been abolished, but it is far less destructive than it used to be. The rate of death in warfare now is probably 1/100th of what it was 50 or 60 years ago. The reason that we have the impression that the world is a violent place is that that's what news is about. News is about stuff that happens, not about stuff that doesn't happen. And all the parts of the world that are free of war, that are free of terrorist attacks, just don't get reported to us. And so we forget about them. We're getting better and better at reporting the violent events that do occur. Something blows up, you can be sure you'll hear about it. But we don't appreciate how much of the world at any given time is at peace. It's an example of one of many developments by which our species is improving its condition. People are living longer. Fewer people are dying of starvation. Fewer babies are dying in the first year of life. More people are living in democracies. More people are enjoying simple luxuries. And fewer people are dying at the hands of other people. People were not aware of these happy developments. And so I wanted to see what was going on, why all these graphs seem to point downward, and what the cause might be in terms of our psychology.
Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker with A Dangerous Idea. Pinker's the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. You'll find more dangerous ideas and links to interviews with Pinker on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, the legendary jazz saxophonist and composer Charlie Parker, known as Bird, is on our minds. Three new Charlie Parker biographies have come out recently. And Steve Paulson, who listens to a lot of jazz, talked about the young Charlie Parker with Stanley Crouch, author of Kansas City Lightning.
Stanley, you start your book with a great scene at the Savoy in Harlem. It's 1942, and the J. McShann Orchestra from Kansas City has just arrived in New York with the young Charlie Parker, ready to show the world what he could do. Can you describe what happened that night?
They were explicitly part of the combative nature of jazz at that particular time. They had been sent a postcard by Lucky Millinder, the opponent, who said, "We are going to send you Hicks back to the sticks." And so they got mad when they read that.
What did Charlie Parker do that night?
See, Charlie Parker's identity in bands of that time was he was the hot man. You know, whenever you see these films where some soldiers are trying to climb these ladders into this fort, and then they roll out this huge cauldron of hot lead, and they pour it on them. That's who he was. That was his job. All right, bring out the cauldron of hot lead now. He was so spoiled that when he finally got interested in the saxophone, he actually thought he didn't need to know music. He could just take his saxophone and go up on the stand and play with these guys. And boy, they laughed him off the bandstand with such intensity that he swore from that point on he was going to come back and he was going to become the greatest saxophone player in Kansas City. He was very gifted with what they call digital memory. That is, that his fingers could remember where all the notes were. So he didn't have to take as much time to learn music that he was reading. And so he started to move at an incredible velocity over a short period of time.
Of course, one of the signature pieces of Charlie Parker's style was his speed. You say that he wanted to increase his speed, trying to figure out how to do it to the point where he was filing his mouthpieces so he could play faster.
Oh, yeah. Everything that could work for him, he became an expert on the mouthpiece. Now, he's in his teenage years then, but other grown men are bringing him their saxophones for him to work on their mouthpieces.
That's the other big piece of this story. I mean, he got addicted at an early age, and I guess first on morphine, really before heroin.
Right.
And it would seem that kind of his years when he got hooked on this stuff pretty much corresponded with his rise as a jazz musician, and they kind of went hand in hand.
The will that he had for music overcame his addiction. See, if he hadn't had that extraordinary will to play and to play on a very, very high virtuoso level, he would have just been swept away by the drugs like many people were. Because when I was talking to Coltrane's last drummer, Rashid Ali, he said, when Charlie Parker got strung out, how old was he? I said, oh, he was about 17. He said, could he play? I said, no, he couldn't play then. He said, you mean he got strung out? And then he learned to play like he played. I said, yeah. He said, well, now that just proves it. He was just sent here as a totally gifted guy because I grew up in Philadelphia and there were a lot of musicians who, if they got involved in heroin, that just took them out of music because it's too hard to handle both of them.
Yeah.
The fact that Charlie Parker was able to handle both of them, and even as I point out in the book, when he decided to hitchhike out of Kansas City, he had to kick the habit, and he did.
Hmm.
And everybody that had experience with him in Chicago, in Harlem, in Washington, D.C., over that period of time, about a year and a half, he didn't use dope. He had kicked it because he knew that it would get in his way.
Charlie Parker, so innovative. I mean, I know genius is an overused word. I mean, obviously it applies here, but have you been able to figure out to isolate Parker's genius?
The first thing he did was that he figured out the rhythm. He was able to swing in a different way, but maintain the momentum of swing. Secondarily, he was primarily a melody maker. And that was what separated him from Art Tatum and Coleman Hawkins and those kind of guys, because in music, they tended to play what they call broken chords, that is arpeggios. But Charlie Parker played melody. He made up melody at high speed, and that had never been heard before. Because Hank Jones told me that when he heard Bud Powell, who was a piano player out of the style that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and these guys put together, when he actually recognized the fact that Bud Powell was playing melody, he was shocked because he'd never heard it played at that speed before.
Hmm.
And so that was a great deal of Charlie Parker's genius. But the other thing was the sheer audacity of him as a player. Because everybody who played with him, they discovered one thing. If you went to the swimming pool and there was a diving board way up there and nobody was willing to climb up the ladder and jump off that diving board, as soon as Charlie Parker got there, he'd say, how do I get up there? Well, you have to climb up this. You're not going to climb up there. He said, I'm going now. And that was him. His thing was, I am going to do it. And so he would purposely put himself in trouble rhythmically so that he would have to figure a way to get out.
Hmm.
And that was the way he lived his life. He constantly was looking for another way to do things and to make them work. So he didn't think that being what they call today audacious, innovative, that didn't actually mean anything to him. His goal was to sound good. See, because nobody cared if you could do something that was eccentric. Eccentricity wasn't enough. You had to make it work. And so that was what he learned from Louis Armstrong, from Lester Young, from Roy Eldridge, from Chew Berry, from these different guys, from Buster Smith. He learned, you could learn all of these different things and you could master all of this stuff, but finally, you had to become an artist, not an artisan, not a person who just knew how to technically do it. You had to be able to make art in the moment.
Stanley Crouch is the author of Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And that's what's on our minds today. We'd like to know what you think of On Our Minds and our other new features. You can join the Facebook conversation on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen and Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.